Welcome to the Partially Examined Life. This is part two of episode 117, discussing the play Antigone. And so far, we had gone through a lot of the different character motivations and why is this thing in the story and not this thing. The last one was on love. Why does Antigone have to be in a relationship with Hymen here at all? I mean, that provides an obvious route for tragedy to occur, that she kills herself, so he doesn't like that, and he kills himself, and then his mom kills himself, so if we didn't have that, maybe you wouldn't have Creon being so totally fucked. So that's a good reason by itself, but still, the basic premise, the tragedy of her facing conflicting duties would still have been there without it. So I guess we should talk more about these other themes like that that come up. And then when we feel like we've exhausted that, I do think that we should try to discuss the ethical issues involved and to what extent they have resonance for the present day. Is that something that philosophers, as opposed to just people interested in good literature,
can I ask reading? Why you guys decided to do this? Why did you decide to take a departure from doing philosophical stuff and focus on literature in this case?
Well, Sophocles is brought up a lot in philosophical contexts as presenting a distinct view of ethics. And even though it's a little oblique, he's not writing an ethical treatise. So we're also going to do St. Augustine coming up and just starting to look through that. The way that he talks about sin is not just a straight up ethical treatise like John Stuart Mill writes, but still you can get a clear picture of a kind of view of ethics, which was hugely influential throughout history. So that even by itself would be enough of a reason, but also just philosophically rich literature is among the things that is within our purview.
So I wanted to say, Mark, you mentioned why Antigone needs to be in a relationship. And one of the things I had mentioned was this contrast between her love for her brother and her love for Hymen. And actually, it's clear that Hymen is attached to her. It's not clear that she's that attached to him. So in that what she says is, this is around line 900 and, well, a little farther down towards 910 in my translation. She's talking about her choice. The wise will know my choice was right. And now she's going to justify it in terms of her familial relations. So had I children or their father dead, I'd let them molder. So she wouldn't have done this except in this specific circumstance. She wouldn't have insisted on burying her own children.
Could you locate that in terms of, like, the scenes?
When she's being sentenced?
Yeah, this is one of Antigone's last speeches. It's her second to last.
So not when she's being sentenced, when the sentencing is
This is her last long speech.
Okay.
It starts, "O tomb, O bridal chamber, O deep dug home."
Towards the middle of that, she's going to say, "Had I children or their father dead, I'd let them molder. I should not have chosen in such a case to cross the state's decree. What is the law that lies behind these words? One husband gone, I might have found another, or a child from a new man in the first child's place. But with my parents hid away in death, no brother ever could spring up for me. Such was the law by which I honored you." So, and then she goes on, "No marriage bed, no marriage song for me." So she seems like she's mourning. "And since no wedding, so no child to rear." In this very same passage, she is both mourning the fact that she's not going to get married, and she also says something which indicates that her attachment to her brother, because he's her last brother. You know, it's odd, because if it were her last sibling, it might be a stronger argument. Like, this is my last familial tie, right? But it's her. There's Ismene. So she has to say something really odd, which is that it's her last brother. In fact, this struck me as odd, and I did a little research, and I found out that many scholars think this is an interpolated passage, and Goethe was adamant about this. He thinks it's totally out of character and totally in conflict with the rest of it. It seems like a weird explanation of her act here.
What about the end of it, that section where she says, "For acting piously, I have been convicted of impiety"?
Yeah, "I stand convicted of impiety, the evidence my pious duty done." Yeah.
"What justice of the gods have I transgressed?" So, I mean, at the end, I guess I would agree that it seems like there's some kind of discontinuity in the beginning. The end, though, seems to be right on for...
Yeah, I'm just talking just about this specific part of it where she's talking about... The rest of it, is purely in line with the rest of the play. But this specific passage, and it struck me as odd before I found out that scholars, or at least Goethe, you know, are adamant about it being...
Are you saying you're like Goethe?
Yes. No, I'm just saying I'm saying I didn't just...
I'm more like Goethe myself.
Lift this from a secondary reading that it actually struck me as odd before.
Two things I heard. So the Almansi article, that psychoanalytic one, makes, again, a big deal about this as showing that she has incestuous feelings for her brother and that this is just weird. However, another thing that I had heard, and I can't remember the source of this, it's some online lecture, I believe, on iTunes U somewhere that I listened to when prepping last summer for this, who just said this was just part of ancient Greek society and a weird thing about it, that they prized their siblings more than that. Everything else is, if your parents are dead, then you can't have more siblings. And of course, even if you are a woman, you're going to value this particular point is not something I remember, but I'm just adding this, that since there was no value placed on women at all anyway, then you wouldn't have her count Ismene in this calculation. She's only talking about child and father and brother, really. So among the men, children are replaceable. Parents are supposed to die first. Therefore, the emphasis on the sibling is just that was part of ancient Greek culture. And I don't know if that's true. That this is not weird at all.
This goes towards this tension between her love for Haman or love versus love for brother. And here it's of course minimizing the romantic love at the expense of the familial love. And again, this goes towards the larger issue of friendship and the way communities are grounded, right? How the state survives, how the state continues. On the one hand, these familial ties are, as Dylan was pointing out, foundational in some sense. And the state, we saw in our politics, Aristotle's Politics episode, that the state is in some way an extension of the family. On the other hand, its propagation depends upon bringing things outside of the family, which Oedipus family was not very good at doing. It depends upon creating these new ties with people who are essentially strangers, right? Turning strangers into family members. That's the other aspect that is critical to the propagation of a state or a society. So one could argue here that Antigone's focus on this is actually quite, you know, that Creon is right in sensing that there's something antithetical to the state in this sort of attitude.
But what if there's like something to be said of, let's say Antigone is sort of a emanation of Creon's stance, right? I mean, one thing that we noted earlier on, especially with the chorus or the people who are telling Creon what to do at the end, and you had noted the sort of ironic jabs throughout. Haman is in rebellion against his father. Antigone is in rebellion against Creon. Creon thinks everybody is in rebellion against him. And that in some way, Antigone is like a nemesis of Creon. I'm a little bit at odds, I think, with the way Wes and Dylan were thinking about Creon's original speech as being somewhat reasonable. But just looking at it from a different stance, if he's being absolutely unreasonable and he's breaking a fundamental rule, which is the dead need to be honored, right? Then is Antigone some sort of necessary response by the order of things? She is his uncompromising character in a different housing, in a different body, and she's speaking for this entire worldview that he is opposing with the state.
You know, John, what you are describing sounds like Hegel's interpretation of Antigone, which I just did a search on philosophical interpretations of Antigone like 5 minutes before we started the discussion. And it talked about, yeah, Hegel saw these characters as representing opposing irreconcilable moral claims. So he actually saw them as kind of characters in his dialectic, that if you say, obeying the state, that's the right thing. That's what you got to do. If you don't, you know, that's really what the social contract is obeying whoever's in charge. Then, of course, you would expect then the antithesis to come along and argue the contrary. And so that's what's being dramatized here.
I'm not so sure if I agree with that. The whole conversation is about obedience to the state. And Antigone and Creon are just talking about different ways to do that.
Antigone isn't a partisan of chaos or of anarchy.
Or democracy or yes. Anything for...
Yeah, I mean, she's a partisan of... She's talking about divine justice being more important than anything else. But divine justice is connected to the state. It's not just something else.
No, absolutely. I would just create a contrasting image, which is to oppose Creon, you can conceive of the state as something that is nested within a series of duties and laws that are larger than the priorities of the state. Or smaller in some ways, like the family, but larger in a bigger sense that a well-functioning family throughout the state is necessary for the state to be healthy. And likewise, a well-functioning relationship to the Godhead or heads is necessary for the maintenance of the state.
Could this be a variation of the Euthyphro question that instead of you're asking, are the gods beloved just because...
Are the gods good because they're loved or loved because they're good?
Yes. So we should obey the state, and the state, you know, normally obeying the gods and obeying the state amount to the same thing, but really, can we piece them apart? Can we say that you only have to obey a state if it is in line with the gods, or is it you just have to obey the state and they are God appointed and so they will do the right thing, or at least you're not in a position to
or the state that. The rules and assumptions that undergird the state, if they are not in line with the divine order, will create creatures who will come into conflict and bring about the dissolution of the state.
So it does sound like it's sort of a proto-social contract kind of thing, but a passive one. It's not Locke's, you know, you have the duty to revolt if the state is not obeying the gods' justice, but that the gods will themselves rain vengeance and put things right, or punish at least.
So we're getting at a classic kind of problem of justice here, which is that in many ways, right, justice runs against our familial ties. So think about Plato's Republic, where I think Thrasymachus' definition of justice, right, is helping friends and hurting enemies, which is why Creon's talk of friendship versus enemies resonates so much. And, you know, some societies operate more on that, in that frame. They operate more on a sense of justice, which depends upon honor and taking vengeance when your honor has been sullied in some way, and observing loyalty to family above all else, even if that means going out and achieving quote unquote justice your own way by killing the person who killed a member of your family, kind of family feud stuff and Hatfields and McCoys and so on, all of that stuff. But as the state grows in power, the concept of justice transcends all of that and really comes down with a heavy hand on all of that type of behavior. You don't get away any longer with, you can't say, oh yeah, I killed that person because they killed my family member. Oh, okay. No. You're going to jail. So the justice starts to turn a blind eye to concepts of familial attachment and loyalty, and also to questions of identity. This is part of Sandel's critique of the Rawlsian version of justice. Its conception of what the good is very, very thin. It abstracts from identity and family attachment and race and any other types of grouping or identity you can think of.
And this tension runs deep in the Greek plays, that the generation of the state is a kind of compromise that goes against something utterly natural. And I am just going to say the example that I was thinking of earlier, which is Aeschylus's Oresteia. And the last play in that group is called Eumenides. So the basic story is that Agamemnon in the first play comes back from Troy, and his wife Clytemnestra is waiting for him. And before the Greeks all sailed for Troy, Agamemnon sacrificed his daughter Iphigenia so that they could get safe passage across the stormy oceans to sacrifice her to the gods. And Clytemnestra harbored a lot of anger about this for the whole time and slits his throat while he's in the bathtub and kills him. And then her son, Orestes, goes and kills her. And then the question comes up, is he's a mother killer. Shouldn't he be killed as well? And in the end, in the last play, Athena stands in judge and Apollo is one of the lawyers in the argument. And the Furies are arguing for blood in this case.
And they've been pursuing him.
That's right. They've been hunting him down. And so there's the question on the one hand, well, you know, he was perfectly right to have done it versus blood ought to be paid. And Athena, on the one hand, judges in favor of the city and lets Orestes go. But she renames the Furies, the Eumenides, or the kindly ones, and puts them beneath the city so that that eye for an eye, familial ties are right underneath the city all the time, sort of founding it, holding it together, despite the fact that there is on top of it this structure that goes against that, that puts it aside, that you can't have that Hatfield and McCoy kind of justice and have a city. But in the end, it is really underneath it the whole time.
Yeah, Creon is sort of on the side of this transcendent justice part of things, the state. But he makes that argument in the beginning, that very first speech, in terms of family ties, right? In terms of friendship. It's an odd way to do it, right? Instead of saying, no, you know, no one, I mean, he does say essentially, no one is above the law and I'll punish my own niece, my own family member. I don't care. But he casts that in terms of, we must be a friend of the fatherland. We must be a friend to the state. That, in a way, becomes a familial tie in its own right for Creon. And then if you look at the way Antigone's doing exactly the reverse, she's arguing in favor of the family ties by way of transcendent justice, which is divine law. This is why I think it's more complicated than just a simple conflict between what I'm calling the transcendent justice versus the familial ties, because those two things turn out to be related to each other in some sense, inevitably related to each other. And I think they're just emphasizing different ends of it. So in the case of the dead, you know, a lot of Antigone's line is also about what's due to the dead. And of course, that's about our ancestors. That's where the laws come from. When we speak of the dead, I think indirectly we're speaking about those formative forces which make the living who they are, right? We're speaking about the culture that's been handed down from our ancestors. We're speaking about the law that's been handed down from our ancestors. So it's not that laws simply appear in a vacuum. That's another kind of familial time.
But it's really important that it's Polyneices, one of their own, or at least shortly there before one of their own, is the dead one. It's not like it's an enemy of the state that's being left to... Well, okay, I guess I should bracket that.
Right, it's a literal enemy, but it's not a historical enemy of the state. It's not somebody from a different state.
Yes, so it matters that he is the brother of Antigone and the nephew of Creon and a very recent former member of the city.
Right. Creon is treating him as if he's the enemy of the state, but on another way of viewing it, he's just a participant in a family squabble, right? He's just someone fighting with his sibling.
Well, he was unjustly denied his time as ruler.
Attagolis refused to step down after they had agreed.
And so from a whole another perspective, he is actually the rightful ruler of the state. It's interesting to me that Antigone never really talks about that.
Right.
But clearly, Creon is making a category mistake.
Oh, God.
That's the proper analysis of the play.
What do we say about wrenching philosophy out of...
Well, I do want to wrench, because you've set up like this whole vengeance and family stuff is ultimately at the root. Is it the historical source? And is part of our reverence that goes to the state is not to this abstraction, but really is, in some sense, to this more barbaric or more primal underpinning. Obviously, that's a very different way of thinking about justice, I think, than we have today, where we feel like, you know, if we all agreed, you know, we're not British common law. We could just change the laws now as a practical matter. We still do tip our hat to the founding fathers, and there's, you know, quite a lot of our political culture is based on that. But at least in the abstract, we make our own laws and we don't feel like we have respect to the law itself. There's more some notion of abstract justice and stuff that we picked up from Locke, and that if our ancestors were wrong about stuff and they had slaves and whatever, then it's not only our right, but our duty to undo that. Is there any sense in which we can map this ancient view that we've been describing onto our modern political situation? Or is it that even useful?
Well, think about how much we've lost in making that transition.
So you're saying our political, the shallowness that we're subject to today is a result of us ignoring this ancient thing. That seems a very
kind of thing. What we've lost, John.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
I guess what I mean is that if you establish a framework within which any individual, I won't say regardless of family ties, but often by just ignoring those ties altogether, everybody's going to get the same murder charge, right? If they kill somebody in their family, that somebody would get for killing somebody outside their family, right? And I'm not saying that example is directly leading to what I'm talking about, but it actually has a social effect, right? Where over time, the notion of family that may have existed at the founding of the democracy has been eroded and replaced with a different idea, or a different social norm.
You're getting at the kind of critique that we discussed in our Sandel episodes. So Michael Sandel wrote several books, but one of them, Liberalism and the Limits of Justice, and I was highly critical of that. So I'm critical of Sandel's project, which is this idea that you can somehow derive a priori the hostility of a liberal state to the richness of people's identities and to their communal ties and to the strength of communities and family. But empirically, I think it's undoubtedly the case that family and community mean less and are not as strong in such states.
Or they have, there's a compensatory sort of understanding of one's individuality that's richer in other areas, like my understanding of myself as a citizen.
Well, no, I'm not so sure that you get the citizen part out of it. I think that you get parochialism out of it. And it's very easy to have a kind of pie in the sky view of small town citizenship and how everybody is valuing their neighbors or getting along or having real arguments. But at the bottom of that ends up being deep parochialism and fear of others and majority exploitation of minorities. Deep, deep history of that. And the thing that liberal democracy is designed to fix is that problem. And you're right, and Wes is right, that it does come at a quote-unquote cost of putting a little bit more independence among people and flattening the way in which the authority of the state deals with them.
Dylan, how are you now on the liberal side of this argument and I'm on the communitarian side? How did that happen?
Maybe where you and I disagree about Sandel is I do think that there's a kind of a priori point to be made about it. That might be where we disagree.
What you're getting at, and I think I sort of stand more on...
But I'm a deep liberal about this. I think it's an unequivocal good.
So. Do you really? Okay. I'm obviously a defender of liberalism and a sometimes strident one, but I think there's a real downside that we ought to acknowledge.
I agree. I think there's something to be acknowledged there, but I think that once you have it, it's very easy to forget all of the downsides. I had a professor who he grew up in a small town in Iowa and talk about how there are really important things about that life that mattered and resonated in his life. And I asked him one time, why did you leave? And he says, it's just too parochial. So you can recognize the kind of beauty of that, but you cannot avert yourself from the real downsides that come along with that. I mean, I think a perfect example is the kind of tight family ties you see in tribal societies, and then just the horrible things that they do to even members of their own tribes, much less members of competing tribes. And you go to places right now in this world that are utterly absent of any notion of liberalism or liberal democracy. And it's just, to me, an untenable way of living. And you can point to beautiful scenes and real ties that bind between families and siblings and stuff like that. And it sits square right next to people stoning each other.
Yeah. And they're also, those sorts of governments are also highly corrupt. And the bribery is a part of what, this is one of the things I thought about with Creon's focus on people taking bribes, right? This idea of he's giving you the negative view of the familial tribal loyalty thing, which is corruption and bribery and things like that. So apart from parochialism, that sort of problem, the other obvious glaring problem is the prospect of authoritarianism, which is sort of perhaps parochialism writ large. Because, you know, parochialism, that's about the oppressive authority of the community socially, their social expectations and what they can do to you. And often it's not stoning necessarily, but it's just shaming and the way gay people had to, were living in America for a very long time, and to some extent still do, this idea of being despised and shunned and hated and ridiculed and all other sorts of things, which have very real consequences in people's lives. But then on the other side of it is just when that power becomes the power of the state, then you're potentially in big trouble as well, because that's totalitarianism, authoritarianism, all that stuff, which is what the liberal ideal is meant to prevent against. But again, it comes with high costs.
But you know, we have strong feelings about the value that accompany these different, let's say, approaches to... One is an approach to statecraft, but another is just culture, right? You know, the previously existing culture. We have strong feelings about those just because we're participants, and in some ways our characters are formed by being in them. But that might be a helpful way of thinking about the play. In other words, when Dylan, you were talking about the horrors of what, I guess what we're sort of identifying as the parochial culture, you're seeing those things in a state of transition in the present day. And we may be seeing them as damaged, not just from our own standpoint as participants in a different type of social order, but also because they are actually in conflict with forces that are being brought about by the change in social order that has made what we think of, like, I guess, again, liberalism is ascendant in certain places or over wide parts of the globe. If your experience is somebody who's sitting there watching the play at the time it was written, when democracy was relatively anew, who is acquainted with all of the mythology and the backstory that undergirds this particular dramatic treatment of this legend, you are sort of swimming in that mythos. And at the same time, in a related way, you are married to a certain ritualistic approach to your cosmology, right? you, in all likelihood, sympathize with Antigone or have participated in the very rituals that she's fighting for, right? And so if you're looking at it from a tragic perspective as an audience member of the tragedy, Creon is, he's talking about everybody who's outside the pale. The words used in the script I have are stiff-necked anarchists and all this stuff. But in a way, he is that guy, right? He's stepping in and announcing the power of this new thing. And he's saying, this is now banishing the rites and the way of life that came before it. It supersedes that. And naturally, you would want, or not maybe want, but you would expect to see such a man take a fall. So when you bring up the idea of Aeschylus, there is something wonderful about the fact that a state has to exist is harmonized with what came before it. But here we just might be seeing the tragic breakdown, not the restoration of harmony or the instantiation of harmony where it never existed before.
Well, yeah. So I guess we don't see what happens after Creon falls and what happens to the state following this. But I do kind of feel like you have that warning embodied at times in the chorus and in Tiresias about Creon's overreaching.
He set himself up to be the representative of a kind of justice that transcends familial ties that were associated with liberalism. But John is pointing out is that he's doing something obviously wrong. That's cast in this play in terms of not honoring the dead or not honoring the gods. In present day, we might talk in terms of rights. Or how would we say what Creon is doing wrong if we get rid of what's due the dead and what's due to the gods?
I do want to just point out real quick, as you're making that point, Wes, that it's hard for us to speak about those things in ways that do not trivialize them.
What do you mean?
Because we don't believe that you should have to sacrifice for the dead and et cetera.
I mean, I think that people would be up in arms if the idea of leaving somebody laying in the street, especially a member, we've glorified the sacrifice of a dozen soldiers gone to just retrieve one dead body.
I think this ties into the Charlie Hebdo thing, too.
Well, it's also, I was thinking of the Tsarnaev case when the brother who died in Boston, they wouldn't find a mortuary that would take him. They finally found one undisclosed, one out of state or something. I mean, that kind of ridiculousness where you're, there's something about once someone's dead, they've paid their price, right? There's that kind of idea that any demands of fairness or justice or something have been sort of answered at that point. And the idea that you are chased into the afterlife by those concerns, there's something wrong with that.
You see it as an immoral or an incorrect judgment, or there's something wrong with that in that we just can't believe in it anymore?
No, I'm saying it's ethically suspect. I mean, it's disgusting.
It becomes a matter of punishing more than just the punished, right?
Exactly.
If you're denying a resting place for this person, it's just punishing their family.
But isn't the argument that it's also political, right? The case before us in Antigone is one which, I mean, it would be maybe interpreting what Creon's doing beyond what he actually says. I mean, he says he's embodying the laws, right? But if you take the point of view that him burying a willful combatant against the state would undermine the authority of the state, in fact, maybe be a rallying point for other underminers of the state. In the case of the Boston bombing, I think that sentiment is much more clear of a combination of not wanting to pay the respect of it, which is very much sort of chasing after the dead. And the other would be a political question of, do we want to have a monument of some sort to someone who did this?
Before we go on, let me stop and tell you about our sponsor, The Great Courses. I know that anybody listening to this, like us, is a lifelong learner. You're passionate about exploring big ideas, and that's the motivation for The Great Courses, learning for the pure pleasure of it. Yes, free-form discussions like The Partially Examined Life are great, but why not also get the opinion of an award-winning professor? So, for instance, to prep for this, I dove into their course, The Great Ideas of Philosophy, Second Edition, with Daniel N. Robinson. And Lecture 5 is on the Greek tragedians on man's fate, where he talks about Medea and Agamemnon and Antigone, and describes ancient Greek tragedy as basically pre-Socratic philosophy, as raising ethical problems that philosophy is then devised to explicitly take on. And Robinson describes Antigone in particular as a precursor to natural law theory, by positing that in addition to the explicit law of the state, there's something deeper, more universal, natural law that drives Antigone to take the actions that she does. I really enjoyed these courses. I want you to check them out. Great Courses has a special limited-time offer for Partially Examined Life listeners. You can order from 8 of their best-selling courses, including The Great Ideas of Philosophy, and all of them are up to 80% off the original price. The courses are available on DVDs, CDs, streaming, as digital downloads, or with the Great Courses apps. To order, go to thegreatcourses.com/PEL. That's thegreatcourses.com/PEL. All right, let's get back to the discussion.
There's an essay by Daniel Mendelsohn in the New York Review of Books. It's basically a movie review of the September 11th movies, Flight 93, and then there was that horrible one that Oliver Stone did. And he basically analyzes those movies, but he puts it in the context of a class he was teaching on, is it Aeschylus's The Persians? The point that he makes, and he holds the Persians up in contrast to the September 11 sort of movie industry that sort of blossomed there for a second. He says, it's really amazing to me, at the height of the Greek victory, where this tiny nation had repelled this gigantic behemoth that essentially seemed to be something that stood against the values that Greece stood for.
So this is the movie.
Yeah, exactly right. No, but he says Aeschylus's vision in the Persians is a sign of the brilliance of Greek culture in that I think it was the year after the victory against the Persians that Aeschylus wrote a tragedy whose central figure was the Persians. He has a very dim view of these September 11th movies because they're in some ways actually obscuring September 11th from us in a way. But there's something about the generosity of spirit, and that sort of comes out of that unique culture that was happening right at that time, that they were able to put their enemies in the microscope and sort of get inside their heads and present this story from that standpoint.
It would be easier to demonize them and to write something, a gung-ho, ooh, we kicked their ass kind of story. That again goes towards this kind of demonization involved in not allowing someone's burial, granting Dylan's points. But as Mark pointed out, it becomes a way of, in the Star Sarnaev case, it became a way of punishing the family. And of course, it goes towards the easy and very anti-liberal collective guilt thing where it's Muslims and this and that. And the same for, in the case of Antigone, I think Creon thinks he's enforcing some sort of justice that transcends family ties, but really he's just engaging in that collective guilt sort of parochialism where he's Polynices was an outsider, or he wasn't an outsider, but he made himself an outsider. It's worse in a way because of the betrayal.
Yeah, the state, as it were, has drawn a new line outside of which you can define the people who are outside. It's just maybe more expansive than a family might draw or a tribe.
So I found this whole attempt to connect the conflict that's going on within Antigone to the conflict that Sandel is describing, or just more broadly between parochialism and cosmopolitanism, right? The idea that there's an objective morality, that it's the same for everybody, that you treat everybody the same, that sort of goes in line with there being a justice that transcends anybody's individual concerns. And on the other hand, that all justice at least is rooted, just like Creon argues at the beginning, is rooted in and is part and parcel of family relations. So, of course, normally we think of doing right by your family as also just doing right in general. And we think of obeying the state, your particular state, as also just being a good person, a good citizen in general. And it's only, I don't know if it's only in our modern time, but it's especially given our spirit of individuality that we cast ourselves as, no. What I am seeking after as an individual, only as an individual can I really judge the objective good and probably what my family, what my tradition, what my state tells me to do is codified. It's going to dilute it somehow. So this is sort of the Protestant ethic coming out of this that then translated itself with the U.S. into something political, into this spirit of individuality. Looking at it from that perspective, the tragedy of what's going on is you've got Antigone, who thinks she's reaching toward the objective, toward the god, but is doing that by clinging to familial ties. And then we have Creon, who also thinks he's reaching toward the objective, towards what the gods want, but he's doing it really with loyalty to me, and I'm the ruler, so therefore loyalty to your government and the way that I am interpreting that Polynices was a traitor. So both of them are trying to reach toward the objective, but because they're in an older time, they don't even have a sense of the objective, that it was a great accomplishment that Plato outlined. No, you don't have to just pay attention to what the gods happen to love. It's that there's an objective good, and that's what the gods actually turn toward. It seems like
either Sophocles is trying to make that same point, or he's just in sort of a pre-modern time, and so he can't make that point because they really just didn't, back in this day, have the notion of the objective good. And then when we got to McIntyre, a more recent ethicist, following Anscombe, this idea that there is an objective good is actually a modern myth, is something that came out of getting rid of polytheism and embracing monotheism. And according to Anscombe's interpretation, the majority doesn't have this underlying monotheistic theological view anymore. Then we actually should learn from Sophocles, that we should learn from this picture, that there really is no objective good that we can all reach toward and have a shared peaceful experience. There really just is these sort of abstractions that we erect upon certain individual sorts of ties.
Or even if there is such a good, it's too thin. You know, ethically, we need a more robust sense of the good. So this even gets towards a Nietzschean type of virtue ethics argument where
yep.
each individual, through the constitution of their character, has their own telos, their own end, their own good.
Whereas coming from a straight up Kantian, yes, the good is objective stance, that's just the genetic fallacy. Yes, we learn about the good from family or from what the state says, but those are just stepping stones. And if you argue, as Sandel tries to do, away from the liberal, the objective, in favor of the individualistic, then you're doing something wrong. You're just confused.
Yeah, of course, you know,
about what the good is.
As I've argued before, I think those two things are compatible. So, you know, the thin conception of the good and the basic idea of rights and things like that is perfectly compatible with a thicker sense of the good where you also value things like family ties.
Part of that point is understanding that the social organization is not the sole or primary way in which you get your ethical understanding of the good. So you would understand your virtue, something like importance of a strong, you know, virtue ethics, but not in a kind of Platonic way where the state is responsible for educating you on those things solely.
Well, you're right. Even on a Platonic view, when we're not talking about the state basically having to take in hand the inferior people that can't see the good for themselves. You know, Plato is our big representative of maybe the originator, I don't know, of this notion of an objective good that's beyond any.
I agree. I think that was a good point. I just was thinking in terms of the issue of the state and the way West mm-hmm. was framing that alongside a thin understanding of the good for a state that is part of a liberal understanding of the proper functioning of a state and this relationship to its citizens, there is a thick understanding of the good for those individuals that is compatible with that state. And I think that part of that is understanding that the source of that thick understanding is not the state. And that might be a way of thinking about a kind of mistake that Sandel may be making. Or maybe let's not say call it a mistake. Let's just call it that. His point of view is that the state has more of an influence, or the culture has more of an influence on that understanding of the good.
Can we just make this a little more concrete? I have a feeling with this whole thick versus thin understanding of the good, we're probably losing a lot of people.
So a thin conception of the good would involve basic commandments like thou shalt not kill. And a thick conception would involve a whole set of religious beliefs, for instance, or any other beliefs associated with your ties to a community. But also to what will help you flourish. So if we get down to the kind of Nietzschean virtue ethics, which extends into psychoanalysis, flourishing and being happy, it's not enough to observe the minimal commandments, thou shalt not kill, and so on. And it's not even enough to observe a thicker Aristotelian conception of the good where you're trying to develop virtues of, say, temperance and justice and courage and things like that. Those are still too generic. At the Nietzschean level, it's about finding out who you are at the level of character and then actualizing that. So it's about virtue specific, not to being a human being, but to being Wes or Dylan and so on.
Which, of course, is tremendously innovative on the part of Nietzsche that, you know, both Creon and Antigone are putting their specific duties as if they're saying the objective good, in other words, what the gods command, that's their easy way to conceptualize that, involves different things for different people, right? Unlike the utilitarian who is going to say we can all obey the same abstract rule, you know, or the Kantian that will be able to lay an entirely abstract rule out for what you're supposed to do, or at least what you're prohibited from doing.
But if you think that the rules are, well, you have certain duties toward the state or towards your family, then the empirical circumstances in which you are going to then give you a much thicker concept of the good. In other words, because your family is telling you to do all this stuff. The state is telling you to do all this stuff. The state is setting up ideals. The family is setting up ideals so that even just having an objective rule that applies to everybody, obey your family or something like that, that then blossoms into a bunch of details.
Yeah. And the question of what was Creon's good in this situation? What was Antigone's good? Obviously they both are not, I mean, Creon went to his ruin and Antigone to her death.
But with honor. Some people will admire you, Ismene, but I'm going to have honor.
Yeah. We don't need to judge this by utilitarian standards or the maximization of pleasure or however you want to put it. It could be that the state's good is something different entirely than either Creon's good or Antigone's good.
I'm having a hard time not identifying Creon with the state's good. I guess I'm just looking at that first screed. I don't know. It strikes me as just pompous. In fact, I think that the translation that we read with Provenza definitely tries to bring that out. I mean, first of all, it's no longer in verse, right? It's in prose. And it sort of has like an address at the boardroom feel, right?
You just said that you thought that Creon was associated with the state's good, but then it sounds like you're characterizing his opening speech as Weasley, and he's not really associated with the state's good. He's taking that upon himself. He's declaring it, but he's just a bag of wind, which I think is how most of us take the character. We don't find his opening thing convincing. Which argument?
Well, I'm just saying that if I'm thinking about the context of the play as a whole and what we actually see happen to Creon, that there is a judgment being passed on the arguments he's making, right?
That they're shitty and that he's not actually doing what is in the best interest of the state.
Right.
He's a bad leader.
But the question is whether are those judgments on the state per se, is this sort of an anarchist type of argument or?
No, I just think that the author might be looking for a way to show what happens when statecraft declares itself superior to a whole world of tradition. And I guess it's what you guys are calling parochialism.
Yeah.
And how it'll destroy itself by taking that stance.
Parochialism is the way of getting at the negative side of that, but obviously there's a positive side to the tradition element as well.
So it's not just a matter of autocracy. That's what I thought was the issue, that he should have been listening to the town elders the whole time. And even if you think that, yeah, okay, somebody has to be in charge, still a wise ruler is going to listen.
The town elders were not of any use in the beginning, except with little, you know,
but they're also terrified.
Passive-aggressive hints.
I mean, in the very
But I'm
first,
just saying he didn't have an opportunity to listen to them.
In the very first interaction he has with them, he says, "This is my will. Take care that you do your part." And the chorus is, "We are old men. Let the younger ones do it." Right? They don't want to bring
right.
that down.
Right.
I do not mean that. The sentries have been appointed. Then what is it that you would have us do? You will give no support to whoever breaks this law. Only a crazy man is in love with death, says the chorus.
Right, and then he accuses them of being ruined by the hope of profit. That's one of his bribery accusations.
I guess I see very little connection between the vision of the state that Creon is putting out there, which I do think is autocratic, and this notion that there is a will of the gods. In a way, I feel like he's lost that sense.
Yeah, but look at that whole previous argument where he's talking about being a friend of the fatherland. And that being the foundation of, you know, so maybe you're saying that he's sort of departing from grounding things in the divine there, and he's just left with the state itself or the land itself.
And that it's not just grounding it in the divine where we think of a divine idea of the good. It's also grounding it in the natural world. It's grounding it in tradition. In other words, I feel like there's a cosmology here that if we ignore, we might sort of misplace the sort of judgment that Sophocles is making on Creon.
Do you mean something different than sort of classical hubris on the part of Creon? That what he's being found guilty of is essentially overreaching contrary to the gods or fate or the way the world is?
Does hubris necessarily take that, the connotations that you just... Is hubris more of a flaw that can have many different types of content?
I would be perfectly content to be accused of misinterpreting that word, I guess. That's what I've always understood it as, having a relatively broad sense of that kind of overreaching there's always kind of a fuzziness between the gods as entities and the gods as representing the natural world and the forces that are outside of human construction and artifact.
I think it critically involves at least pride, right? Or maybe I'm misinterpreting here, but and this is what I took in part to be the significance of the chorus's response to Creon when they say, "This resolution, Creon, is your own," because he's trying to speak as if he is the state. And they are saying, well, this is your decree, and the implied thing is not the state's. Or you are actually acting not out of love for the state or for fatherland, as you claim, but out of self-love.
You're not acting as a king properly, and a king for whom the citizens and the state come first. You're acting out of your own personal agenda. Yeah.
Yeah, so what's wrong with, screw all this connecting it with the fundamental ethical principles in conflict, that what we have here, just the psychoanalytic take on it, it doesn't matter that we didn't all read this Almansi paper, but yeah, you're getting at that whatever they say, the different characters, in terms of their justifications, that I'm just upholding the will of the gods, of course everybody is going to act here and maybe always acts out of deep personal interests. Mere reverence for the gods is not going to actually motivate you to do anything. Just like it's fear that motivates the chorus to do what they do. And it's paranoia and wanting to solidify his power that's motivating Creon, and some weird death drive for Antigone.
It's much different. So Antigone is acting out of love for her. So this is, again, where I think the theme of love is actually quite important, and the talk of love at the end of the play. So Antigone seems to be acting out of love for her brother.
But all you need is love.
And Creon out of self-love. And Hymen, of course, out of love for...
Well, and his father, too, right? He seems to be genuinely concerned about
that's right.
Creon overstepping, trying to find a way to tread in between that. In some ways, I find his speeches the most...
Touch with reality,
most deft and revealing. Yeah. And they're the only ones that present not someone sort of standing on their soapbox and just screaming out what they think. That's Creon and Antigone. But he sees multiple sides of what's going on.
Right. He starts out the whole conversation with his father saying, "I support you," and then tries to gently lead him in a different direction. And then, of course, Creon erupts. And
In fact, I guess he never really talks to, even in the plot of the play, you don't see him ever talking to Antigone, because in principle, he shows up at her tomb and she's already dead. And I guess her sister is the one who's trying to talk her out of it, but she never really has the balance that Hymen has.
She's not principled in any direction or another. I mean, well, she is willing to die with her sister at one point in the play.
John was all like, "I'm going to be Lucy Lawless's fiance. That's awesome. I'm going to get to do kissy scenes with her."
Listen, tragedy, the real tragedy here was that I was typecast yet again as a young lover. I'm tired of that.
A young lover not getting any.
No, he got some in the end. He joined her in death. Leaned on his sword and then climbed onto her body. Oh, no. She was hanging, so he grasped her body. The love, the Liebestod.
we haven't talked about Eurydice.
The one line that she had? She's important, I guess.
Well, that was my question. Is this just something to heap insult to injury on Creon to just make things even shittier for him? Or is there something else?
He can't go on to be the founder of a dynasty or the continuer of a dynasty.
I'll read the line. It's a 927 on mine. The Chorogos says, "Oh, look, Eurydice, our queen, has she overheard us?" The messenger talking about Hymen being dead and Antigone being dead. And she says, "I've heard something, friends, as I was unlocking the gate of Pallas's shrine, for I needed her help today." So she needed wisdom. "I heard a voice telling of some new sorrow, and I fainted there at the temple with all my maidens about me. But speak again, whatever it is, I can bear it. Grief and I are no strangers." And then she hears the news and she goes and kills herself. So what's the significance there? I mean, "I heard a voice telling of some new sorrow." Is that implying that she, like Tiresias, is getting divine signals about this? She was trying to get into the shrine, but she's not in the shrine yet. It's not that Athena has told her that something is wrong. It's a voice. She could be overhearing some random person talking. It was unclear to me.
She doesn't get into the shrine. As she's unlocking it, "I heard of my own sorrow," and then she faints, and then John is on to the significance of it, which is this idea of Creon being deprived of any descendants, of any dynasty, of any, obviously he can remarry, but of this particular line
getting back to the wedding that can't happen, the offspring that can't happen, the reuniting of the line, or the creation of the heir of Laos, that obviously goes through Hymen and Antigone, and the barrenness is there. But Creon can't father another child to start the state again. Like, the state dies with him.
You're not acting as a king properly, and a king for whom the citizens and the state come first. You're acting out of your own personal agenda.
Creon, if he gets remarried, unless he marries his Mene, which would be a disaster. If he marries anybody else, it has to be somebody that doesn't have a name. Because in this society, that's my theory, it's we have the important characters who are only in this family. And then everyone else, the chorus, the messenger. He can't say, hey, it's Ned the messenger. No, he just has no name. The sentry has no name. David Brind would not approve of such hero worship in a text like that. The chorus themselves should contribute positively to resolving the difference. Well, who has a closing or something like that? Something that is bursting at the seams.
We haven't heard Wes read some Greek for us. It'd be a nice way to go out.
Oh, that would be nice.
The meter is not going to be correct.
I don't think anybody else will notice except you.
All right, I'll read a little bit of this. I don't know. We're going to get ancient Greek people telling us about what I've done wrong, but oh well. Just the very beginning of it. O koinon atadelphon ismenes kara. Arois otiseus ton apidipu kakon. Hapoion ukinon etizosen tele. Udengar ut algenon ut ates ater. Ut aiskron ut atimon esthopoion u. Tonson tekakon uk. A pope ego cacon. Cainun tuti au fasi pandemon pole. Kerugma, there it is, kerugma. Kerugma thenae ton strategon artios. Eces ti kesecusas esse lanthane. Prostus filus steconta ton extron caca. Caca means bad.
And that whole thing is just translated as Ismene, dear sister.
That's the oldest Bugs Bunny gimmick, where they meet the natives and, you know, they say two words and the translation is like.
Anyway, I couldn't find someone reading it online just to get a better sense. So it's in iambic trimeter. So I honestly don't know how it's supposed to actually sound as far as the meter goes.
As a theater person or former theater person or whatever, just throw out there. I don't know how difficult I would always find a lot of these more abstract ideas that would come out of the play to actually stage them in the play.
They can't even stage a fight scene. Certainly they can't stage an abstract idea.
To stage it in such a way that these ideas sort of unfold in some way. It's very difficult.
All right. Well, thanks. This was nice. If we wanted to still be going after 3 hours and feel like we wanted more, we would have had to do more than one play. But we really soaked this thing, I feel, for all that we possibly could have. Next time, Wes and I will be on a special bonus episode where we talk more with Jonathan Segal, our guest for the Schopenhauer episode. We only talked about music toward the end with him, really, even though the whole thing was supposed to be about music, but they were so hard to get through Schopenhauer. And I know Jonathan wanted to rant about music more. So we're getting him and then Victor Krumenacher, who is the bass player from his band, Camper Van Beethoven, who is also a very smart, talkative guy. And so we don't even have a text there. We have some topics about music, about the songwriting life. It should be pretty interesting. We're supported by your donations. Please go to partiallyexaminedlife.com. Make a contribution.
Big donors since last time include Colin Negrich, Timothy Perigo, Chang-Chi Young, Max Keville, Dylan Tucker, Michael Offerbach, Adam Balch, Brian Snell, Steve Crawford, Keith Maggart, Alice Parra, Alex Connolly, Tobaloba Oni, Aaron Schur, Steve Hell, Steven Seberg, Jimmy Latton, Robin Smith, Daniel Meisler, Lauren Gable, and Isabella Montgomery. Thank you. Thanks also to the many smaller donors, including those who are newly or on a continued basis signed up for our $5 a month citizen site. I want to remind folks that Partially Examined Life is an Amazon affiliate. If you go to partiallyexaminedlife.com, click the Amazon ad in the right-hand margin, make the purchases that you're going to make at Amazon anyway, then around 6% of the money you pay will go to us at no additional cost to you. So please bookmark that. It's a way you can support us easily on an ongoing basis if you buy stuff from Amazon. We are also an Audible affiliate. Audible is the biggest distributor of audiobooks.
They have a very good subscription service. If you want to try that out, go to audibletrial.com/PEL. I want to point out, if you do that, or even if you don't want to sign up for their service, but I personally, Mark Linsenmeyer, have now narrated several books available at Audible or through the Amazon site, including one that just came out on the lives of Voltaire and Jean-Jacques Rousseau. I also did one on Nietzsche. I did one on Leonardo da Vinci. I even did one on surviving a zombie outbreak. So go search for my name at Audible to get those. Hey, we've got a Facebook page. We've got a Twitter feed. We have a blog, partsexamlife.com. You can go and discuss this yourself. You could start a not school group, just like the one that we already had, but discussing a different Oedipus play. Certainly you want to go there and discuss the one that we had. There's also going to be an after show on this episode with Danny Lobel. So that's going to be on June 28th at 3 p.m. Eastern. Sign up at Partially Examined Life.
All right.
Okay.
John, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, very much. Yeah,
thank you for having me. It was a lot of fun.
Thanks, John.
Oh, hell, awesome. Hell, thank you.
Yeah.
Good night, everybody.
Good night. Take care.
Good night.
Good night.
Waiting his native park.
This is going to be a little self-pity kind of thing called Woe Is Me. One, two, three, four.
Kiss you to the sky.